Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Boquette. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, speaking to the environment, this morning we're going to invite you to experience the best of Connecticut agriculture at the 11th Annual Easton Farm Tour coming up on August 10th, and at the same time help one of the farms on that tour, J&L Orchids, celebrate their 50th anniversary. We'll get all the details on how to make your visit to Easton the best it can be, and we'll get a crash course on the magic, mystery, history, and botanical particulars of what makes orchids so unique and sought after. Then we'll catch up with the Community Fund for Women and Girls, which just delivered grants totaling $130,000 to 12 nonprofit partner organizations working to advance gender equity in the region. We're going to zero in on a number of programs receiving grants and find out why the fund decided to make a huge investment in the statewide Connecticut Collective for Women and Girls. Then, in the second part of our series, You've Got Mental Health Parity, Now What? We're going to visit with the director of Newport Academy and continue our conversation about Connecticut's new mental health parity law that was recently signed by Governor Ned Lamont and how it will support and assist the thousands of state residents and families challenged by mental health issues. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Boquette, right after this reminder. Close your eyes and imagine a sea of 450,000 sunflowers all in bloom across 15 acres of farmland. You can take hay rides through the field of sunflowers, a special stop to feed the family-friendly cows, and you'll have a chance to sample more than 50 flavors of homemade ice cream, including a special sunflower flavor sold only during the 10-day Sunflowers for Wishes Festival. Sounds like the perfect idyllic summer day, right? Well, Buttonwood Farm in Griswold is hosting its iconic event, Sunflower for Wishes, for the 16th consecutive year through July 28th. And while they last, bouquets of five sunflowers will be available in exchange for a $10 donation to Make-A-Wish Connecticut. 100% of all proceeds from the sunflower sales, as well as t-shirts, note cards, hay rides, and other donations will go directly to Make-A-Wish Connecticut. Sunflowers for Wishes is located at Buttonwood Farm on Shetucket Turnpike in Griswold. The event is open to the public from 10 a.m. until dusk through July 28th. And if you'd like more information on Sunflowers for Wishes, just visit their website, sunflowersforwishes.com. Well, for the second year running now, we're pleased to be promoting Citizens for Easton, an Easton Farm Tour. It's a self-guided tour of local farms, really easy to get to whether you're coming down from, Newtown or northern Fairfield County, the Southbury area off 84, or right up off the parkway in Trumbull or Easton. We are here with Lucas Carino. He is one of the owners and been working here at the farm since around 2017. But we're in a great place because we're co-celebrating the farm's 50th anniversary. Lucas, first, let's talk a little bit about yourself. What's your background and how did you come to love orchids so much that you decided to make a career out of it, at least for now?
Well, I studied mathematics and then I worked in construction. And after that, I sort of started growing orchids as a hobby. And on a trip through the Merritt Parkway, we saw the greenhouse here, and that's when me and my brother really started to get interested, and we sort of bought the greenhouse and the business from the previous owners. They were starting to retire, and that's when we sort of took the reins.
So you're sort of one of those agricultural superheroes that snatches the farm out of the jaws of the residential developers, so to speak. I'm sure as a farmer, you know this is happening all over the place. So people like you that make the investment to preserve working farms here in Connecticut are really, really important.
I mean, it keeps things different. I don't know.
Well, did you tell me about when you? Some people collect reptiles. Other people collect baseball cards. What made you get into the hobby of orchids?
I mean, part of it was just the fact that You can go a week and ignore your orchids. There's so many kinds of orchids. Like, when you talk about a daisy, you've got an idea of what a daisy looks like. You tell me to imagine an orchid, it's so nebulous, there's so many varieties that all I start thinking about is the roots, the nature of, like, there are six parts to the flower, but then how they look is entirely different from one genus to another. So it's sort of that indescribability of an orchid.
And there's a timeless mystique, it seems, about this flower. Books have been written, poems have been written, movies have been made about orchids and people's search for them or want to enjoy them. Tell us a little bit about the orchids that you grow here in Easton, and are they in any way unique to this farm, or are they the orchids that you might be able to find somewhere else on the planet?
So we mainly have catered to hobbyists, because they're that largest flowering genera. They're found all over the world, except for Antarctica. They predate Pangaea, predate that breaking up, the first orchids. And this started out as a hobby back in 69. A little earlier than that was when they started their the actual first collection. And it was a hobby that started out as trying to collect all the different kinds, and especially the miniatures. So we try to branch out, try to find things that are new and unusual. Since there's so much variety, we kind of get tired of seeing the same thing over and over, so we try and find new types of orchids, new shapes of flowers, new kinds of flowerings, new kinds of leaves. We started out really to cater to hobbyists, to show people new kinds of orchids. That's sort of what we've been doing for 50 years.
Do certain orchids require a lot? You said, it's something you could leave for a week and come back and it'll be all good. But are there particular types of orchids that may require, more attention or a deeper rooting, if you will, in, the botanical science of raising them?
Yeah, there's a bunch of different really delicate, really distinct, and fine plants.
Yeah.
That sort of like Lepanthes and Macrocliniums. These are things that usually come from like South America and the Colombian area or the Ecuadorian, Peru. Some things you can find in Machu Picchu. Like if you climb up there, you'll see some really nice orchids down in the area. Hmm. And because they come from all over the world, they have found niches that no other plant can grow in. So when you're talking about Lepanthes, they're generally pretty small. There's some larger ones, but a lot of the really nice ones are things that are about 2 inches tall, have a flower that looks like a tiny little fly, except brightly multicolored, a lot of them, or they have patterning on their leaves. And these are things that come from what are known as cloud forests in the Andes, and that's where you have they're at the top of the Andes where the clouds come through them and the trees catch all the fog and the so that's how they stay watered. So trying to grow them is a little difficult because they need the pure water, sort of constant temperatures. You can't let them get too hot, you can't let them get too cold, can't give them too much sunlight. They're sensitive to a lot of pesticides or things like that. So you have to be careful about what you use on them. The harder ones to grow, I would say, are more the terrestrials. Mm-hmm. In that sense, too, as well, because the Lepanthes are delicate, but they're pretty simple once you get the hang of them. The terrestrials, they come from different earths, different types of soil that they need. So there you have to know a little more about the region they're from, what kind of if they go through a dormancy. So the orchids that grow in the outside the tropical zones, the more temperate areas, they're a bunch that all they need is just a dry rest. They don't. You can leave them in your house. There's some native orchids here, but those need a winter rest, and you need the right kind of. You need to make sure that they don't. They're buried somewhere where they don't get too cold, but they can't stay too warm. Otherwise, they don't end up finishing their cycle.
Yeah. So. They seem so beautiful that it would seem that they should quite outpace roses as something you'd want to give to thrill somebody, or you know, convey your love for them, or you know, do something special for them. But do I have it right that as soon as you cut them, like they don't sustain like a lot of other giving plants that you'd put in a vase in your house?
So certain cut flowers are still in use. There's the dendrobiums. There's the Ascascendas, there's the Phalaenopsis, the moth orchid that you see at grocery stores. Those do pretty well. They used to be used for corsage orchids, corsages, yeah. Like the Cattleya that was the corsage orchid, big white,
right.
fragrant thing.
Yeah.
Again, they don't last, I mean, honestly, they last about as long as roses.
Oh, okay.
The issue is orchids are slow growers. That's sort of what makes them able to adapt to such a wide variety is that they drink less, they grow slower, so they're able to withstand the more extreme environments that they're generally find them in. So it makes it harder to make an industry out of it, simply because they grow so slowly. You don't see them, you can't just plant a field of them and suddenly wait for and just harvest them up the next year. You have to wait about 5 or 6 years.
Oh, okay.
So
Is it also true that certain types of orchids, especially maybe more relatively newly discovered types, or slight variations of a more standard type of orchid, are very, very expensive or very, very valuable?
There are a couple. Depends on the demand, honestly. There are some newly discovered orchids that may have been discovered within 3 years, and you're not going to get much more than like $40 for a little plant, which generally is not that high for an orchid, especially once you consider how old they are.
Yeah.
Just because no one really wants them, they look the same as a bunch of other things. But then when you go to the lady slippers, especially with the Chinese lady slippers, the ones that are near the Himalayas, a lot of people have really gotten really interested in them. Those, you see, those are where you worry about over collecting, over harvesting from the natural environment, and where people come in and damage the environment specifically to sell them, because there's a craze about lady slippers that there isn't as much in a lot of other plants. And part of it is just they're even slower growing than a normal orchid. They flower, some will flower only every third or fourth, sometimes even tenth year.
Wow.
So you have these plants that are that have these really strange, they have a pouch instead of a normal flower shape. They have it. And those are the ones that you see some collectors just going in and paying like $10,000 for a really special plant. Part of it is also just the fact that you can't clone these kinds of plants. You can't. So the only way is to slowly divide them up as they get older.
Well, before we go and we talk to Bill Kopensky about the farm tour, you are part of it, but you're also celebrating your 50th anniversary next weekend. The farm tour, of course, coming up in the first week in August. So you're really going to have kind of two weekends of excitement here at J&L Orchids. You are also here for retail customers basically like 7 days a week.
Yeah, not 7 days a week.
Nope.
Generally, I'm around because I live here, but I try to take Tuesday, Wednesday off. But we're here for retail. If you have any need any services, we're open year round. So if you need to come in the middle of winter, we're around then too, because orchids need to stay alive then too.
Sure.
Yeah, and next weekend we'll be having our summer sale where we have a bunch of vendors come in with different specialties and supplies.
And how about a website for people that want to find you?
JLOrchids.com. We're also on Instagram and on Facebook if you want to check out some photos that my brother takes.
Very good.
Of the different types.
Well, great to meet you. Lucas Carino is one of the co-owners of JNL Orchids here in Easton, which will be one of the stops on the self-guided Citizens for Easton Easton Farm Tour. Lucas, great to meet you. Good luck with this anniversary celebration and the farm tour, and hopefully we'll meet you again. Thanks. All right. Well, we're switching gears now, and we're going to talk to our returning guest here representing Citizens for Easton for the second time, and hopefully the second of many. Bill Kapintz is the Vice President of Citizens for Easton, former first selectman of this fine small town, just off the parkway in the area of Fairfield and Bridgeport. If you're coming up, if you're listening out on Long Island or down in lower Westchester County or the city or way out in Connecticut somewhere, Litchfield County, come on down. The Easton Farm Tour event is coming up on Saturday, August 10th from 10 to 3.
Yes, we're having the 11th annual farm tour, and there's a number of farms that you can visit in Easton, and it's a great day to come out, and there's going to be activities up at the starting point up at Morehouse Road, and get up there and get a map and get around to all the places. Right now, we're in J&L Orchids, and there's some beautiful orchids down here that we'd love to see. Be sure to ask the owners about the ones that smell like chocolate. I couldn't believe it. She she brought me down and showed me the chocolate-smelling orchids, and they're really quite fragrant.
Just don't eat them.
No, yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe you can. I didn't ask. This year it's up at Morehouse, up at the school, Morehouse Road. When you go past the firehouse, you want to take a left at Morehouse Road and go up that road, and that's where it is. So that's where we're starting off this year.
Okay. Are we still looking at cooking demonstrations and games for the kids?
Yeah, there's going to be some children's activities up there. There's going to be some food trucks that'll be there. There'll be a chalkboard that may say something about some of the special activities that are going on that the various farms are developing. So it's a good place to start out. And if you get a copy of the map, then to the extent there is a break or a favorite at any of the farms, if you show them the map, you get the benefit of that.
So folks can go to citizensforeaston.org/the Easton Farm Tour. For information on this. Easy to find. All they do is put Easton Farm Tour in their search engine?
Yeah, well, or you can just put Citizens for Easton in your search engine. We've been around for about 45, 50 years now, and we work to preserve the rural character of Easton. I know when I was selectman, I coined the phrase that it's a jewel of Fairfield County, and it really is. It's a very unusual town, very rural town, and we really appreciate it and try to keep it that way.
Well, tell us a little bit about the group. You've been involved for quite a long time. What is it that makes these groups that seem to be very centric to the communities that they serve actually important for the region that they reside in?
Well, one of the regions that Easton is important is that there are two reservoirs here, and we supply water through Aquarian Water Company to about 600,000 residents of Fairfield County. The water goes down as far as Greenwich at times, so we're very important that we keep our town rural and we keep it unpolluted, because it's providing drinking water for a lot of Fairfield County people.
In talking with Lucas Carino, one of the co-owners here of J&L Orchids, I was saying how it was so serendipitous that he was driving up the parkway and saw there was an orchid farm, and then discovered it was for sale and ended up taking it over from the owners, who may not necessarily have otherwise had the opportunity to sell it to someone who wanted to continue farming. Easton's culture and heritage of agriculture is super, super important, not just to Easton, but to the entire Fairfield County and sort of the western New Haven County area.
Yeah, you're correct. And we have some great farms, and it's wonderful to be able to shoot over to Sherwood's, for example, and pick up the fresh corn from his farm and get it right off the stalk, so to speak. And I shop there a lot. And it's serendipitous that I wound up here. My wife was driving through one day, and she saw somebody unloading a bulldozer. She said, "Are you going to develop that land?" And he said, "Yeah." And she said, "Can we buy a lot?" And he said, "Of course." So that's how we wound up here.
Oh, there you go. Well, it was great to see you and visit with you again, Bill. Bill Kopentz is the Vice President of Citizens for Easton and the former first selectman of this community. He is here with us today, along with Lucas Carreno, co-owner of J&L Orchids. As we heard earlier in the segment, they're celebrating their 50th anniversary here in town next weekend, and then the following weekend, the weekend of August 10th.
Yes.
From on Saturday, August 10th, from 10 to 2, and correcting our earlier error at Samuel Staples School is where right. They go to register.
It's actually just a little past Samuel Staples where we set up.
Well, there'll be signage. People will find it.
There's signage, and once you get up there, it's pretty obvious where we are.
Excellent. And folks can learn more about this group and the farm tour and other activities involving Citizens for Easton by just going to citizensforeaston.org. Bill, thank you so much for being part of the show.
Thank you again. Appreciate it.
Well, for several years now, we've had the opportunity to visit with representatives from the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven. We do that on several different occasions, whether it's in cooperation with their work in the Naugatuck Valley and that foundation, or more lately, we've been really excited to be able to talk about the Community Fund for Women and Girls and the great work and underwriting that's being done for that organization at the Community Fund for Women and Girls annual meeting. Awards totaling $130,000 were distributed to 12 nonprofit partner organizations working to advance gender equity in the region. We're going to talk a little bit about that with the development director for the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven, Sharon Capetta, who is also a lead staff representative for the Community Fund for Women and Girls. We also have on the line Kate Farrar. She is executive director for the Connecticut Women's Education and Legal Fund, and we're going to talk to her in just a little while about strategic investments that are being made to a Connecticut collective for women and girls. So, Sharon, I hope I didn't butcher that too badly, but welcome to the program. You know, we've been great partners with the foundation for many, many years, and we're so thrilled again to hear about the disbursements to these 12 nonprofits. Let's start just with a little background for folks that are listening beyond that stumbling introduction. Just bring us up to speed on the lead up to and the awarding of these 12 nonprofit grants.
Sure, John, and thank you so much for having me on the program along with Kate to talk about the Community Fund for Women and Girls. So just a baseline, it's a women's endowment fund in Greater New Haven, so it's the only women's endowment fund in the region, and there's an annual grant-making and convening program that's held, and we highlight the great work that's being done by nonprofits that are focused specifically on advancing women and girls. And you mentioned the Pride Center, the grant to the New Haven Pride Center. It's to help them create programming specifically for women and girls and those who identify as female, and drawing attention to their work and helping support the development of programs for women and girls. So that shows you, it's a good demonstration of the focus of the Fund for Women and Girls. And in terms of the grant making this year in 2019, one of the most common threads through all of the grant making is around economic security. And we know that there's a number of ways to approach economic security, whether it's through job training or programming that helps it provides education or financial literacy or non-traditional employment sector. So there's a lot of ways to attack it. And you kind of see that in the various programs and services offered by the 12 different grants that you referred to.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about a few of those grants and the organizations and programs that will benefit from them. But I did want to take a few minutes to just kind of look back on a panel discussion that you held at this recent grant-making event, which was called The Care Economy, Women, Wealth, and Work. Did you hear anything about communities or even states or counties that are kind of looking at the challenge that this poses in terms of the immense demand versus the low wage compensation that is coming to so many women who are represent heads of household, I imagine, in many cases?
Well, it's interestingly, I guess it's fitting because like many gender issues and gender equity issues, what we see in New Haven is very similar to what we would see in Stamford or New London or Hartford or Middletown or Providence or New York or L.A. So they're kind of universal issues, and that's something that was highlighted in the panel discussion as well.
Excellent. Folks, if you just tuned in, we're talking with Sharon Capetta. She is the Development Director for the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven. Today, we're talking about the Community Fund for Women and Girls. Regular listeners to the show over the past few years have heard us reviewing and talking about and talking to some of the recipients of the many grants that have been distributed. This year, $130,000 went to 12 nonprofit partner organizations, including a number of which have appeared on the award-winning For the People. So, Sharon, let's talk a little bit about some of the organizations. You touched upon this first ever grant that went to New Haven Pride Center. Are there any other organizations that were first ever recipients or who came to the table with applications evidencing either very unique and innovative programs or programs that the selection committee, the grant committee, saw as having huge bang for the buck potential in terms of ROI on the money that was donated or granted to these organizations?
Sure. So let me unpack that just a little bit. One of the newer grants, in addition to the New Haven Pride Center to increase the programming available to women and girls in the LGBTQ plus community. One of the promising grants was actually to an organization called Community Bonds. And Community Bonds does a lot of work on immigration across the state. They have a bail fund and all kinds of educational programming. But they are organizing. We were able to provide seed funding for a formal organizing initiative to deal with mass incarceration. And in this particular instance, it will be led in Connecticut by women and specifically by women of color. So that was a great opportunity for the Fund for Women and Girls to be kind of first in and provide that important seed funding. So that's a good example of that. And others are programs that the Fund for Women and Girls has supported frequently. A returning grant, for instance, was Student Parenting and Family Services, which there are parenting teams in our school systems, and Student Parenting and Family Services has an incredible program that increases, that makes their graduation rate for parents who participate in this program for their students graduating from high school is extraordinary. So if you want to talk about return on investment, I think that's a great example.
Yeah. We talk a lot on our program here, Sharon, about STEM careers and not only developing that track, especially for young women, but helping to kind of defeat the stigma that might be tied to STEM careers and the ability for young women to achieve them. And we're so excited to see our friends at the New Haven Free Public Library have stepped up with a great program that was one of the larger recipients of grants this round. Can you just talk a little bit about Tech Titans?
Sure. This was initially something that the Fund for Women and Girls was involved in seeding, but this grant was to expand their Girls Who Code Club, which is for elementary school girls in grades 3 to 5, and it's a weekly program. Well, what's interesting about this, and in the participants learn coding basics and the history of STEM, so kind of based on this idea, if you can see it, you can be it, which is common in this work. It will expand it to additional branches of the library system, which will provide more girls, young girls, ages grades 3 to 5, the opportunity to really dream and experience what coding looks like. So we're excited about that. We look forward to hearing how that goes.
Excellent. Once again, folks, if you just joined us, we're talking with Sharon Capetta, and Kate Ferrara is also with us. Sharon is the Development Director for the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven. We're talking about the latest distribution of grants through the Community Fund for Women and Girls. And when we come back after our break, we're going to meet Kate Ferrara. She's Executive Director for the Connecticut Women's Education and Legal Fund. And we're going to talk about a strategic investment that was made by the Fund for Women and Girls for a collective that is also going to benefit women and girls across Connecticut. We'll be back right after this break. Stick with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on the Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Connoisseur Media's Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The Hospital Elder Life Program, HELP, at Griffin Hospital in Derby, is looking for volunteers available on weekends to provide additional support for elderly patients. You know, research shows that between 30 and 50% of seniors can experience a decline in their physical and cognitive abilities during a hospital stay. HELP is a comprehensive, evidence-based patient care program that provides various volunteer interventions like mealtime assistance, friendly visits, activities, walking, and exercise to help patients maintain their optimal level of function. Training and supervision is provided. No previous medical experience is required, and scholarship incentives are also available for eligible college students. The next HELP training schedule is beginning in the fall, so if you'd like to learn more to become a HELP volunteer, call 203-732-7466 or look up the HELP program at griffinhealth.org. Well, we're back. Thanks for hanging around. Obviously, you're interested in the future of women and girls here in Connecticut, and we appreciate you listening. Sharon Capetta is with us. She's Development Director for the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven. As you heard in the first segment, half of our segment, the Community Foundation for Women and Girls has granted a package of distributions, $130,000 worth this year to 12 nonprofit partners. But one of those strategic investments was to the Connecticut Women's Education and Legal Fund, and we're going to hear about how that is tied to the overall effort and meet Kate Ferrara. So Sharon, just tell us a little bit and transition us and bring Kate into the conversation.
Sure. QELF, the Connecticut Women's Education and Legal Fund, plays a really important role across the state in a number of different initiatives, working on the paid leave work and a number of different education and advocacy work, along with providing legal service referrals and education for women. So both direct service and advocacy. So they were the natural partner to tap into and to ask them to use their extraordinary abilities to help convene a group of a network, if you will, the Connecticut Collective for Women and Girls, which is a network of nonprofit providers who are women-led, women-serving, girl-serving organizations to keep them connected, to add to their capacity to do their work and to keep an eye on public policy issues that affect women and girls in our state. So it's been really a wonderful opportunity to work together across the state for the Women's Funds, and Quilt has been doing a fabulous job with the collective.
Excellent. Well, Kate Farrar, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us and sticking with us through the first part. So I see that both the Connecticut Women's Education and Legal Fund and the Connecticut Collective for Women and Girls were both recipients of grants. Are those grant initiatives sort of tied together, or are they going to serve distinctly different projects or initiatives under your guidance?
Thanks, John, and thanks again for having us. And I'm happy to respond to that question. They actually are serving very distinct needs and goals of our organization, and as Sharon said, the goals of the Connecticut Collective. So we've been fortunate to receive grant funding to support our legal education and advocacy work for women across the state, but particularly in the greater New Haven area, from the Community Fund for several years now, and that's really to fill a civil justice gap for women who aren't able to afford representation. But the grant that Sharon mentioned, that's a strategic investment for the fund, is for Quelf's role as really the backbone organization in leading the Connecticut Collective for Women and Girls, which really is a national model of collaboration in our state. We have now over 30 women and girls serving organizations across the state, many from greater New Haven area, that have really been a part of launching this network a little over a year ago, in really coming together to make sure that we are coordinating our policy work, as Sharon mentioned, better coordinating our program work, and really just sharing resources and strengths and skills that we have at this time to make sure that we're using our collective power to advance women and girls in the state.
So was developing and sustaining the Connecticut Collective something that was on the radar for the Connecticut Women's Education and Legal Fund for some time prior to its formation, and it was just sort of waiting to launch?
Great question, John. To take us back in time, actually Sharon and I met and discussed really the need for this type of network when we met up and had a conversation with each other back in 2016 at a conference in Washington, D.C. called the United States of Women. And at that time, we were really looking at our state, and there was a lot of changes afoot in the landscape, especially that there was the defunding of what was in our state for many, many years, the Permanent Commission on the Status of Women.
Right.
And it was a moment in time when we realized, you know, there was even just this greater and greater need for women and girls organizations to be connected, but we really had lost that connection point with the defunding of that commission. And again, the changing landscape where there can often be fewer resources but even greater needs. And Sharon and I had that conversation together in 2016, and then really started bringing groups together to figure out what did we really want. And out of many of those conversations amongst the leaders of these organizations across the state, the concept of a network was born. And this network is really meant to serve, again, the needs and the wants of these organizations, and really be leading on opportunities that we can really work together. For instance, we have certainly coordinated on a range of policy issues, as Sharon mentioned, but we're also making sure, for instance, on issues of girls' leadership, that we're sharing best practices with one another. And we're also taking advantage of opportunities to really bring national-level focus to our state. Right now, there is planning afoot between our Connecticut Collective and the United States of Women and the Governor's Council for Women and Girls to bring what will be a statewide summit for women and girls to the state called the Galvanize Program. And that really wouldn't be possible unless we had been really coordinating and working together over the past year.
Well, it just sounds like an incredible network of collaboration that's happening, and it's really wonderful to hear that the Community Fund for Women and Girls through the foundation has been able to play such a critical role in sort of pushing it over the starting line and helping to get this thing launched to the point where it's going to be drawing not just statewide but hopefully nationwide attention, and may actually serve as a precedent example of how other states, counties, or municipalities could do the same thing. So kudos to all for having an eye on that and getting to the point where we are this year. I can't wait to come back and talk more about the project and the collective as a standalone segment. But Kate, I appreciate you giving us a great orientation to that now, and Sharon, for your continued support and work with us on For the People and helping for our listeners to understand just one of the many ways the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven is serving the region through the Fund for Women and Girls. Folks, if you're interested in learning more or perhaps making them a beneficiary of your philanthropy, you can go to fundforwomenandgirls.org to learn more. Once again, Kate Farrar and Sharon Capetta, our guests this morning on the program, thank you both for your great work, and we'll be talking to you again soon. Well, if folks joined us last week toward the end of the program, we're going to continue closing a number of For the People episodes with individuals who either represent organizations or who were involved with or will continue to support and sustain Connecticut's new Mental Health Parity Act. Recently, Governor Ned Lamont has signed legislation that's going to ensure insurance coverage for people in the state of Connecticut suffering from mental health and substance use disorder conditions as they would for other illnesses. We were thrilled that this legislation was spearheaded by State Representative Sean Scanlon, who's right here in one of our districts, and Senator Matt Lesser, as well as State Rep Brenda Kupchick down in Bearfield. This was in response to a December 2017 study by independent actuarial experts at Milliman that showed Connecticut had some of the nation's worst disparities for access to affordable mental health care services. And we're so pleased to welcome into the conversation Dr. Jennifer McLeamy. She is the executive director of Newport Academy. So Dr. McLeamy, thank you for joining us on the program. And first, let's start just giving us a little bit of backstory on Newport Academy.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I'm really honored to be here to talk about this incredibly important topic. Newport Academy is a series of adolescent residential and outpatient treatment centers started in Southern California about 10 or 11 years ago and then expanded very quickly into Connecticut. And then we are continuing to expand into Northern California, Washington State, Virginia. So our focus really is on both residential and outpatient treatment for adolescents with mental health issues, also substance abuse, and we're soon going to also be serving young adults with mental health and addiction.
Excellent. Have you or your organization been engaged in similar types of legislative initiatives outside of Connecticut?
Yeah, we were started in California, and so we've really been at the forefront of trying to support and push forward any changes that we see that can be supportive of individuals with mental health issues. It's a population that is often not particularly advocated for, or not necessarily advocated for in a way that's effective. And what we see over time is that mental health issues impact physical health as well, longevity, wellness, relationship satisfaction, pretty much all the aspects of wellness that we would hope to improve through physical care. If we're looking at through mental health, the lens of mental health treatment, we can improve that as well.
Well, we know that the study that was the impetus for the eventual signing of this law in Connecticut found that patients we're so often forced to use really expensive out-of-network coverage far more often for mental health and substance use disorder care than for other types of medical care, because coverage for the disorders was inadequate and because there's a shortage of mental health providers. Tell me a little bit about the thought process and ramp up to that, and how you're actually going to be accommodating more young people at your facilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. And, you know, one thing I really want to say is that I've worked at many different types of settings, and Newport Academy is really the first place I've worked where I think that the treatment really makes sense, because we focus on the whole person and really on the whole family system. So in Connecticut, we currently have a 54-bed residential facility, as well as outpatient programs. And this week, we're actually doubling the size of our residential facility. So we'll have over 100 beds available for adolescents with mental health and or substance use. And really, our approach is, you know, okay, a lot of therapy, of course, but, you know, you can get therapy in many different settings, but really to focus on the wellness of our clients. So lots of therapy, lots of individual therapy, but also equine-assisted therapy, yoga, Reiki, martial arts, experiential therapies, an educational focus that really works alongside with our therapists so that the teachers are aware of what a given client is bringing in. And so as we expand, we're really trying to scale the work that we started in California in 1 6-bed residential house to be able to impact more families. And I think another really important piece of all this is that the families are, they remain highly involved even though their child is in residential treatment. So it's not a setting where we'll take an adolescent and fix them up and they don't have contact with their parents, or they have minimal contact and then they go home kind of bright and shiny and new. We really take the stance that mental health is something that evolves in the system and is impacting and impacted by a system. And so we think that that system needs to be part of the change. I really think of it like a set of gears. And so you have, you know, a set of 4 or 5 gears, and they're all spinning in the same direction, and it's all seemingly working, but the product that they're making isn't sustainable or isn't healthy. And so what we sometimes find is that, you know, a family will ask us to take one of those gears, you know, the identified problem, which is often a teenager, and fix that, but you can't take a gear and make it spin in a different direction and then put it back into the old set of gears that haven't changed. And so we really work hard to make it so that when our clients do return home, that it's a healthier system and that everybody is better able to support each other.
And tell me a little bit about how Newport Academy is positioned and how you will continue to deliver services and support to individuals who are self-medicating due to an undiagnosed mental health issue and have developed some sort of substance addiction or addictions, alcohol and or some suite of different types of drugs, to kind of, you know, mitigate the impact of an underlying mental health situation?
That's such a great question, and I love how you frame that, because that is often what we'll see is, you know, clients who've been tagged with the label of addicted or substance abusing, but it often stems from that underlying pain of, you know, something's wrong with me, I'm different, I don't know what it is. And, you know, I just also want to say that a lot of mental health issues look different in teenagers. So whereas adults, we might recognize depression because we don't want to get out of bed or we've withdrawn or isolated from our loved ones, teenagers with depression might be very irritable or acting out or seemingly conflict disorder or oppositional. And so it really can hide under the surface undiagnosed, just as you said. And people will frequently turn to substances as a way to numb their feelings, escape their feelings, somehow avoid, which, as we know in the mental health field, avoidance of feelings is probably the worst thing that we can do, because it just shoves them down and it keeps us from being able to work through and boss through that. So at Newport Academy, we really understand that. And, you know, we approach it from different directions. If somebody comes into our care with addiction or substance use problems, we will certainly target that head on. We're able to accommodate, you know, tapers off of certain things like benzodiazepines that clients might have come to us with. We can support them medically through that process. And then we also simultaneously start to get in and look at what's underlying. You know, where are the early attachment ruptures from their childhood that are still causing pain? You know, where are the relationship issues that have never been discussed, that are the things that they're trying to numb or avoid in the first place? And we really work with our clients to help them to understand that, you know, life will happen and there's real suffering in the world and we have to deal with that. Parents die or people in your family have physical or mental health issues. And so we have to address that pain and work with that pain. But when we're trying to avoid those feelings, then we create this cloud of suffering around all of that pain. And often the things that we've done to try to avoid in the first place are the things that lead to ongoing problems, you know, avoidance, school refusal, drug use, that type of thing.
Great. In closing, Dr. McLemy, in the last couple of minutes that we have, could you impart a little bit of information or advice to parents or caregivers of young people who, you know, basically hear an idea coming out of the mouth of an adult and sort of automatically reject it or resist it? Not to grossly stereotype an entire generation, but it is often the case that young people who are trying to be directed to get the kind of help that Newport Academy can offer them will be resistant. Is there a particular way that you would counsel or advise a parent or loved one to help get that young person through the door, if you will, and get them the appropriate exposure so they won't be either automatically resistant or resistant throughout the attempts to provide them with the help they need?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. I mean, first, what I would say to parents is you're not alone. I've yet to seen a teenager who just bounces into treatment really excited to be there. You know, usually there's some relief on some level, but there is often that resistance or I don't need this. I think really the first step for parents is to show your teenagers that you're willing to do the work too. Kind of like I said, around that idea of the gears, you know, if your adolescent thinks that you see them as the problem, capitalized, then they will be more resistant because they feel already kind of penned in or pigeonholed or that, you know, they're being unduly scrutinized or something unfair is happening. So I think one of the most powerful things that a family can do is dive into the treatment themselves. You know, show your teen that you're willing to go to family therapy with them. Maybe go to family or couples therapy yourself or individual therapy yourself as a parent and talk with your teen about how you're seeing changes in your own life. You know, whether they want to or not, our teens are still watching parents to see, you know, how they're going to interact with the world. And what we often hear when a teen does engage in treatment is, my parents were doing this work too. So I think that that's a big piece to just promoting that trust and that sense of, you know, you're not just the problem, but you are suffering and we want to help you. And here's some ways we can do it. I also think there are ways that once a client lands in treatment, you know, they can be engaged more fully because it's not exactly, at least at Newport Academy, it's not always what kids are expecting. It's not, you know, a locked facility. It is not a place where they're just kind of shuffling around and doing a lot of therapy back to back. There's so much that's meant to be enjoyable and experiential and interesting and, you know, push their boundaries and, you know, go off on a hike or, you know, something that they've never tried before experientially. So it might not feel like the type of treatment that they've had before where it's just sitting in an office and speaking with someone.
Very good. Great to make your acquaintance, Dr. McLemy. Dr. Jennifer McLemy is the executive director of Newport Academy, just one of the many organizations that are opening up and enhancing availability to individuals now that Connecticut has seen a Mental Health Parity Act signed into law by Governor Ned Lamont. We thank you for your great work and the work of your staff, Dr. McLemy, and hopefully we'll be speaking with you again on this and other subjects of benefit to our listeners. Thanks for being on the program.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.